Hello, and welcome to this episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real-World Perspectives. My name is Diana Isaacs, and I'm joined by my co-host, Natalie Bellini. And in this episode, we want to talk about continuous glucose monitoring accuracy. And you might be surprised, like, why in the world are they talking about that this time? Well, one of the reasons is because there were recently two publications that very much focused on this topic. And one of them is interesting. It's called The Myth of MARD, The Limitations of MARD in the Clinical Assessment of CGM Data. And if you're not familiar with MARD, it stands for Mean Absolute Relative Difference. And often this is the term that is used to describe CGM accuracy. It's actually the average glucose levels. Usually it compares to venous lab draws, the YSI Yellow Springs instrument. But basically, comparing glucose values at different ranges and then coming up with averages based on that. And the bottom line to know is that generally speaking, the lower the MARD, the higher the accuracy. That's kind of been the general rule of thumb. And before we even dive into this, I just want to let you know where this was. This was actually published in Diabetes Technology and Therapeutics in a special episode, a special edition that has a lot of good topics from CGM and automated insulin delivery. And Natalie and I actually co-authored another article in this series that maybe we'll talk about later. But so this is kind of hot off the press. And so, Natalie, curious your thoughts on this whole topic of MARD and kind of the myth behind it.
Yes. So thanks, Diana, and welcome, everyone. So this Diabetes Technology and Therapeutics Journal is released with the ATTD conference that's happening in Florence this year in March, actually. So this article specifically was written by Robert Vigersky and John Shin. Robert Vigersky is the chief medical officer at Medtronic Diabetes, and so what we're looking at, and I think what he's saying is, let's take a step back and realize that all of the CGMs that qualify for what's called iCGM, interoperability CGM, are FDA approved to dose insulin. And when we start doing the MARD itself, it's really going to change depending on where those data points happen to be in the number, with the number of people in the study and with the number of people that had high highs or moderate highs or low lows or very low lows. And that all changes that MARD slightly. So if I looked at, let's say, 300 people, and I got a MARD with this continuous glucose sensor, where all of them looked at on the market and said, okay, the MARD on these 300 people is 9.2%. If I pulled 300 different people and did the exact same study, I might get a completely different MARD, because the numbers and the relative are very low when we're looking at some of these data, isn't it? I don't remember off the top of my head how many people we looked at when, like, Tandem Control IQ or 780G were actually FDA approved, but their numbers aren't high enough to power this. You know, when we look at cardiovascular studies, there's thousands of people in those studies. There are not thousands of people in most of these CGM studies, especially these iCGM studies.
Yeah, and I think some important things to note are, so these are based off of averages, right?
Right.
And so a 10-point difference with a glucose level of 70 is going to be, like, let's say it's 60, the lab value is 60 and the CGM is 70, right? That's 10 out of 60. That is a large percentage, as opposed to if glucose is 180 and the venous lab value is 190. Suddenly now it's 10 out of 190, right? And so these studies, depending on how many data points are lower, can really manipulate the MARD that you're going to get. You're going to get a much higher MARD generally if you have more lower data points. In addition to that, there's certainly differences between CGM sensors. I mean, I would say they're all now have gotten to the point where the accuracy is incredibly good and you can dose insulin off of them. You can make treatment decisions off of them most of the time without needing to confirm with a finger stick. So they are all very good. But some may have strengths in certain areas versus others. Like some may be slightly more accurate in higher ranges. Some may be slightly more accurate in lower ranges. So it's very hard to compare head to head. But also, there's very few head-to-head comparisons to begin with. Most of the time, there's not actually a universal way MARD needs to be studied. So it, depending on how one study did it and how another study did it and how many data points, the types of patients that they had, type 1 generally will have more glucose variability as opposed to type 2. Glucose excursions done in the trial. Did you try to kind of get more lower readings or try to get values when glucose was changing rapidly? These are all going to influence that MARD. And so really to say, oh, well, this MARD is 8.3% and this MARD is 9.7. So the 8.3 is better. We really can't say things like that. And I think that's the purpose of this article, to say we've been so led astray that, like, okay, lower is better. That means it's more accurate. And unfortunately, it is not that simple. These are like complicated algebraic equations that rely on a lot of factors. And it's just, it's not as simple as saying lower is more accurate.
And I think we need to always think about where we've come from and where we're going in clinical practice. So in my lifetime, an A1C of 8 was great. And when I was a younger person, A1C, you're 8, you're good to go. 8.5 was even, 9 was even acceptable. And what did we learn from that, right? As we brought those A1Cs down, we realized that we were reducing the risk, cardiovascular outcome risk, right? Microvascular risk, that whole with the DCCT and the NIDD, I mean, I'm sorry, the UKPDS trials, right? And so we start driving A1Cs down. And then what happened? People had these low A1Cs, but they were crashing their cars. Is a low A1C better? Well, not if you can't, when you're having hypoglycemia unawareness and you're causing accidents. If I push a MARD to push a MARD to be able to say mine is better because I pushed a MARD, is that really better? Right now, what do we tell the people we see? You and I see patients 4 or 5 days a week, right? What do we tell them? I say the CGM is FDA approved to dose insulin from, and there are going to be data and comparisons where one company looks like it has a more accurate CGM than the next. And guess what we're going to have in 3 to 6 months? Another study with this same thing. So I encourage you all to read this article and that really addresses MARD at this very, where are we going with this now, right? Is a MARD of 5 really going to be better than a MARD of 6? And where do we stop with it all and actually try to get these sensors more accurate in the end? So it'll be very interesting. There is a talk at ATTD about this, and we'll have more on it after the conference, I'm sure.
Yeah, and one other thing that I thought was really good that they went into in the article is just about the clinical relevance of all of this. And so one example they gave was, okay, let's say you take a MARD of 9% versus a MARD of 10%. What does that mean when someone's sensor glucose is 100? Well, that means that most of the values are going to fall between 90 and 110 if the MARD is 10%. If the MARD was 9%, that means they would fall between 91 and 109. So is that clinically relevant?
No.
If you go in the higher ranges, it's like 180 to 220 if the glucose sensor glucose was 200 versus 182 to 218. So it's like, also, you can get crazy, like, oh, 8.5 versus 9, this is better. But even if it is 8.5 versus 9, clinically, it's really not.
It doesn't really change the clinical decision-making for the majority of people out there. It truly, truly doesn't. I can't think of a time when it would.
Right.
Because, when you do the finger sticking, it's the same thing. And, you know, it's like if you check twice in a row within minutes of each other, they're going to be different numbers. And then what do you use? And people get this, what we don't want this to do is drive confusion and say, I picked this CGM or this pump or this system because I thought that this was more accurate, even though there might be a integrated system out there that might have fit the person's needs better.
Right. And then on top of that, there also can just be differences in the sensor day number.
Yeah.
So if it's a 14-day sensor, there could be a difference on day 14 versus day one. And
right.
So that also like kind of just throws other variables in there. So all this to say, I think this is a very informative article, and I encourage people to read it to better understand some of the myths and fallacies with MARD. With that being said, I think this is a good segue to an also pretty hot off the press article that likely you may be hearing about, because it was a head-to-head comparison between two of the biggest CGM systems, the Dexcom G7 and the Abbott Freestyle Libre 3. And this, we're trying to really just speak objectively about this, but the key takeaway from the article was that in comparing them head-to-head in kind of usual conditions where people, they weren't doing glucose excursion, people were wearing each sensor at the same time. So G7 for 10 days, Libre for 14 days, and just kind of doing their usual thing, but they came in several days for 8 hours at a time to have venous lab draws done at the same time that they could observe the sensor glucose readings and then calculate a MARD from that. And they also did something interesting. They also used the capillary glucose, so finger stick glucose. They provided patients with a Libre 14-day reader to check their glucose. And on the days that they weren't in, they were also able to use those for comparisons. And I'll tell you, the key conclusion from this that the authors found were that the Libre 3 was more accurate than the Dexcom G7 sensor in these metrics. Overall, the MARD that they calculated from the study was 8.9% with the Libre 3 versus 13.6% with the Dexcom G7. And those are pretty different, actually, than what the package inserts say. So let's try to unravel what is happening here. So, Natalie, you want to give some of your kind of top level insights into what do you think, why such discrepancies from what is in the package labeling? And kind of, are you surprised, or what do you think about kind of the differences in MARD between this head-to-head comparison?
Sure. Thanks, Diana. So a couple of things. This was a multi-center study. So single arm prospective with 55 people. Okay. So the numbers of people that were looked at were very low. And I think we all need to remember, again, we talked about this earlier in the podcast, when you look at a very low number like this, you can get some significant differences like this and then do it again and not get the same significant differences. So before we even start talking beyond that, I think that's a big part of it. We did, we know some changes in MARD can be, there's a bias with right arm wear versus left arm wear. Why is that? Well, the majority of people are right-handed. And so is there a little bit more muscle in this versus the left arm? Is there, right? So how we looked at things and what happened, just remember, only 55 people. And then accuracy was assessed by comparing the sensor data and laboratory reference values on a YSI, which is our standard, we called it the big red box in clinical trials, right? It was a YSI instrument and capillary glucose values. So I think that, again, there were some Dexcoms that came off early. There were some Libres that didn't last the whole time. I think that in this one head-to-head trial, that this is the result. I don't know, in all honesty, if we had the same head-to-head trial again, we'd get these same numbers. As a non-betting person, I would bet that we wouldn't, because 55 is too low to really make huge claims about.
Yeah, and just some other things I do want to call out. So we previously talked about how lower glucose ranges are going to impact that MARD and can increase that MARD. So overall in this study, because there weren't glucose manipulations, there were very few low levels. There was actually only one in each group that was below 54 in the YSI group. And then there were 34 in each group that were between 54 and 69. So in total, 35 in each group. Now, something to keep in mind, like you just said, is that there were more sensors that did fall off early in the G7. Now, why that is, like, I don't know. That's a whole separate topic. But that means the total N and the G7 group was lower. There were
smaller
3,640 total data points in the G7. There were 4,020 in the Libre 3. So what does that mean? That means the more low range is going to be a bigger percentage in that group. And that can affect MARD, right? That can absolutely impact it. So that's certainly one of the differences. Another thing just to kind of call out is that this study was done by three different sites, three independent researchers that are well credentialed and everything like that. But the study was funded and it was designed by Abbott and everything. And so keeping in mind that there can be differences in terms of just, like we talked about earlier, different strengths between different systems. And so we see a lot of competition in this space, unfortunately. We see claims from other companies saying they're the most accurate. And so I think this is a response to kind of the competition that's out there. But I personally would just really like to see our efforts focused on other areas of diabetes care. I think that we know clinically that both systems are accurate and they are serving our patients well. And so I would just, I'd like to see nobody making claims. And I hope that people don't misinterpret the results, because this is a small study. And so I just don't know. We can say, yeah, in this exact study, in these exact conditions, the Libre had a lower MARD compared to the seven.
Absolutely, it did. Right. Yep.
Right. But I can't tell you that this would be replicated in another study with a different population and with different glucose excursions and designed slightly differently. So I think we just have to be careful with how we interpret it. And it's easy to just kind of see this study, see this headline and read about it and say, okay, this must be the way it is. Now Libre's the most accurate sensor. And I just don't think that's what we can take away from it. In my mind, I take away that all the FDA-approved sensors on the market right now are accurate and are great. And it's wonderful for people with diabetes to have options.
And not only accurate and great, but FDA-approved to dose insulin on the number and not... And the sensors now, you know, people will try and say, well, I want to calibrate. No, leave it alone. Unless you feel differently from the number that it says. And so if your heart is racing and you're covered in sweat and you're a little bit dizzy and it says you're 126, you can't believe it, right? But beyond that, we really do tell people to trust the sensors. When we see inaccuracies, Diana, we see the same things. We see it with dehydration. We see it with pressure. We call them pressure lows, right? We do see some inaccuracies, and we as clinicians have done such a good job in the past, I don't know, handful of years, keeping sensors on longer, improving the accuracy or the misinformation that the sensor gives because of it's getting bad data, right? If you push on a sensor on the arm, on the abdomen, wherever that person has chosen to place it, you've displaced that interstitial fluid. And so you're going to get inaccurate data because you just moved all of it around, right? The same thing with dehydration, those kinds of things. I think we need to focus on understanding that in the past, the competition is coming. There are going to be more continuous glucose sensors, and MARD is going to continue to be talked about. But we as clinicians need to trust in the system and the processes in place about FDA approval for dosing insulin or not. And I would never recommend a sensor right now that wasn't safe enough to do that. Because then I look at the type 2 population and say, you know, okay, these people might be on a basal only now because of the Medicare coverage. And, you know, it's less important to have a perfectly accurate sensor at meals, but why would I pick a less perfectly accurate? Well, I would never do that. So to me, it needs to be FDA approved to dose insulin from, and that's what I want to use for all of my patients.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned the part about calibration, because that is another variable in this study. So GPS can be calibrated, Libre can't. I mean, they're both factory calibrated, but you just have the option to calibrate with a glucose meter. And so in this study, people were not allowed to calibrate their G7. And so you wonder, how can that impact the certainly it can have an impact on the results. I would say in the real world, for the most part, we encourage people not to regularly calibrate because they sometimes make it worse. But there are certainly times when you get a sensor that does seem a little off that calibration can be helpful. So that's kind of a whole other thing that wasn't allowed in this study. So we can't we don't know how that would have impacted it as well. So,
well, great discussion. Before we wrap up, I did just want to mention, going back to that very special issue, getting ready for ATTD, Natalie and I co-authored along with Katie Lingen and David Moth. It's called Removing Barriers, Bridging the Gap, and the Changing Role of the Healthcare Professional with Automated Insulin Delivery Systems. So we were excited to contribute to this article. It definitely talks about the whole changing landscape and the role of different healthcare professionals and how a lot of it has taken on more of a psychosocial kind of role because of the fact that these systems are working so well to get people in range and really minimize hypoglycemia. I don't know if you wanted to add anything to that, Natalie.
No, what a joy. I mean, you know, let's call out Katie. Katie is on her way to medical school, and it was such a joy to write with her, and the best of luck to her. And David Malls is just my pediatric idol for pediatric endocrine. What a wonderful, fun group to work with.
Yeah. So, and lots of other great articles.
Yeah, great articles in this. Yeah. If you're not a member, the Diabetes Technology and Therapeutics is an amazing journal that really does offer real world evidence and publication. We read it every month and talk to each other about the articles and good stuff.
And this one is open access, so even
yes,
you can still access it. So, well, great discussion. Thank you to everyone for tuning into this episode. And that concludes this episode of Diabetes Dialogue. We hope to catch you next time.